Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Welcome back. It's our tradition to begin by introducing ourselves. Actually, it's our tradition to begin by asking everyone to silence their cell phones and forgot to before the meditation period. Sorry about that. So we'll go around and each say our name, and sometimes the facilitator has the privilege of adding a little question so that people get to individualize. So I was thinking a lot about suffering this week, and some of you may have seen the suffering of Paris Hilton on television. I was just thinking, my name is Peter, and I was thinking that suffering really does come through everyone.
Mark Olson.
Nobu Yamaji.
Michael Altshuler.
Francisco Ancelis.
Carl Wolf.
Kay Matsuda.
Jay Corbett.
Darren Little.
Bruce.
Rich, I don't know.
Michael.
Paul Albert.
Harley Shapiro.
Remy Littell.
Todd Hope.
David Lewis.
Chris Shelton.
Marvin Snow.
Doug Potter.
Peter.
Joe Kapolka.
Larry Shumka.
Ray Dyer.
Sigmund Hecht.
Eric Wagner.
Joseph Richardson.
Jack Richards.
Jack Busby.
Place beside it.
Michael Langdon.
David Margolis.
Marvin Zappa.
David Axel.
Roy King.
Steve Carson.
Peter Washburn.
Bill Childs.
Jim Stewart.
Robin Levitt.
Louis Sisma.
Maurice Kelly.
Dave.
Ron Albuquerque.
George Hubbard.
And I'm Justin Hecht.
Is that everyone? And we have one late arrival coming, so we'll give him a chance to introduce himself. So today our speaker is Justin Hecht, who really needs no introduction because he's a long-time GBF member. But for those of you who are new, he's also a psychologist who practices union analytic therapy and has been practicing Buddhist meditation for many years. His presentation to the Sangha today will discuss the intersection of union analytic therapy and Buddhist meditation, which has informed and supported his work. Emma, would you like to tell us your name before we begin?
Oh, I'm David.
Welcome. So I will turn the meeting over to Justin. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter. And as Peter said, I'm going to talk to you this morning about the intersections between Buddhist practice and the practice of Jungian analytical psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. And I'm going to first start by talking about some of the noble truths of Buddhism, and I'll be giving you some case examples, and then I'll be talking to you about a Jungian perspective on some of the cases that I'll be presenting. Then we'll have some time for questions. Peter, what time do I need to stop?
It depends on how much you want to leave for questions. We usually start the announcements around noon, so if you want to leave 10 minutes for questions, then 5 minutes for questions.
Whatever. Thank you. Yeah, we'll go up until about 10 minutes. I'll leave plenty of time for questions. I'd like to tell you, first to introduce myself a little bit further, I am neither an expert in Jungian analysis nor an expert in Buddhism, but I think I know more about Buddhism than most Jungian analysts, and I'm pretty sure I know more about Jungian analysis than most Buddhists. So someone once called me an eternal student, and I think that's true. I've been studying these two disciplines for about 20 years now. And what I'd like to do is let you know, as Peter said, how they have informed and supported my life and my work. At this point, I'm 45, and my life and my work are almost inextricable. So I feel very lucky and blessed in that way. It's also a delight to be here addressing so many friends and to have my mother and family members here. So I'd like to acknowledge you and say thank you, Mom, and thank you, Eric, for coming, and welcome to this space. Welcome to other friends. So Some time ago, I was studying the Four Noble Truths, which all of you know are the foundational elements of Buddhism, and it occurred to me that I was once again going back to the beginning and thinking about how powerful these foundations are and how often I see them ignored in life and how frequently they cause problems. And so this began to germinate an idea in my head about how the Four Noble Truths provide a lot of work for me in my psychoanalysis practice, and how they also provide me with a lot of teachings. And so I began to think that this might be the idea for a book. So this is one of the chapters of those of the book that I hope to write, or that I hope will write itself through me. So I'll be reading it, and then we'll stop and have questions. So the Bodhisattva vow of the Mahayana Buddhists goes like this. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are numberless. I vow to enter them all. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. The Dharma gates, you may know, refer to the passages or ways through which one can come to know the Dharma, which is the truth or the wisdom, as I understand it, not just of Buddhism, but the truth and the wisdom that is behind existence and ultimate reality. So Dharma is a huge idea. Dharma gates are huge ideas. I'd like to tell you about the two Dharma gates that have been most important to me in my life as a psychoanalyst. These two Dharma gates are an eclectic understanding of Buddhism and the analytic psychology of Carl Gustav Jung, the great Swiss psychologist and psychiatrist who lived from 1875 until 1961. I hope to show you how these two Dharma gates sustain me in my work, and hope that the insights that I have learned through these two complementary disciplines are useful to you. I'll give you a bit of personal and theoretical background, then present pieces of several case examples, and comment on the cases from both Buddhist and then a Jungian perspective. First, a word about the case examples I'll be using. They're fictional creations. They're composite characters, similar in some ways to some of the work I've done with people, but all are altered in important ways. Not only has all of the identifying information been concealed, but not one of the stories that I will be telling corresponds completely with any one of my former or current patients. I believe that the stories that I will be presenting are human, archetypal stories, and that we can each locate a piece of ourselves in these fictional characters that I'll be presenting. I also want to state that I have the deepest respect for my clients and patients. They have the courage to come to my office and allow me to help them in their struggle to understand themselves and those that they are close to. While I may defend myself against it in different ways than my patients do, I am no stranger to psychological suffering, and I'm no stranger to neurotic, or in Buddhist terms, profoundly unskillful behavior. Doing psychoanalysis is very hard work. It's especially hard if you have to pretend to be neutral, as my traditionally Freudian psychoanalytic professors initially taught me in my doctoral program. I was cautioned against expressing my opinions, directing my clients, or intruding too much into the psychic space of the client. The theory was that through the process of attending to the client, providing them with a neutral space to learn and grow, they would eventually become unstuck and resolve the various problems that had brought them into therapy in the first place. I found it impossible to stick with what the neutrality demanded of me. I found that I had powerful reactions to the stories my clients told me, and that I formed powerful opinions about how they were contributing to their own misery. I also began to learn how their insistent struggle to hold on to defenses that they had learned at different times in their life was contributing to that misery. I reflected on the therapists who had helped me the most and realized that these were people who were courageous and took a risk to say what they thought I should do in a situation, or told me bluntly how I was kidding myself, and then the implication of what I should do next became obvious. I also noted that I felt less psychic pain after these sessions with therapists who practiced in this way. I felt that for me to try to maintain a pose of strict neutrality left me feeling bored and empty. There seemed to be very little point to the work. The relief of misery might be possible through understanding, but where was the moral framework that supported the whole enterprise and supported me as a practitioner? When Buddhism found me in 1988, I was immediately struck by the psychological power of the Dharma of the Buddhist teachings. I've come to love the simplicity, the clarity, and above all the utility of the Buddhist morality. It has since become an anchor for me in the practice of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. I want to say something about William James, who was the great Harvard professor of psychology at the turn of the 20th century. He said, sometimes people will say, well, that's just theoretical, and his response was, nothing is as practical as a good theory. And I think that's true both about Buddhism and about Jung's psychoanalytic theories. Rabina Korten recently made the point here in this sangha that there's a clear and obvious difference between positive and negative mental states, that you can go back to the idea that all beings want to be happy, and a mental state that contributes to that happiness is a useful state, is a skillful way, and one that doesn't, isn't. And many psychoanalysts are afraid of making that judgment, and through Buddhism I've become not afraid of making that judgment. Buddha stated that it is critical to watch your thoughts. Thoughts become habits, which become intentions, which become actions, which then create karma. So the obvious role that meditation plays in creating good mental health, it strengthens your ability to watch your thoughts. You're able to see how you're creating your own misery. In a way, the process of psychoanalysis is like allowing a trained professional to watch your thoughts in meditation. But what if the analyst merely watches you getting into the same traps again and again? To me, it seems that the bodhisattva vows with which I began this talk suggest that we need to do something as therapists or as people to respectfully point out to others when something is going astray. I think that here, the Buddhist idea of the klesha, or the unskillful or painful emotional state, is a complete parallel with Jung's idea of the complex. We all know about the Oedipus complex, but there's also the inferiority complex, the sex complex, the mother complex, on and on and on. And I think that there's a real similarity here. Thinking about the kleshas, we know about the unskillful states in Buddhism are defined as some combination of greed, which is clinging or attachment, anger or hatred, and delusion or ignorance. And I've seen that Jungian complexes are always fueled by this circle of delusion, anger, greed, and ignorance. There's always some combination going on. I also want to mention, I think it's a bit of a synchronicity or coincidence, but my meditation sessions are 45 minutes every morning, and a Jungian analytic therapy session is 50 minutes. So there's a nice parallel there. If someone comes in, my dogs will greet them, there's a kind of a sense of settling in, and we have this suspense of a meditation, a period in another space, and then there's the exit. Now, when I work with people, or when you work with your own meditation, the delusions that you see in yourself can sometimes be astonishingly obvious to you, and all of us, in a way, are amateur psychoanalysts. We all love to analyze our friends and relatives and partners. We love to see what's wrong with them. And the way that our partner is deluded or someone else is deluded can be astonishingly obvious. Sometimes it's more difficult to look at ourselves. And what I'd like you to do as I tell you about the different cases that I've created is to think about what way you can relate to these people. So I want to talk about the Four Noble Truths, which are the fundamental statements of Buddhism. And I could give a whole talk on the psychological problems that people get into by failing to accept the first of the Four Noble Truths, but I'd like to give just a small examples. As you remember, the first noble truth, essentially, is that life is hard. I know that this noble truth has been translated in many different ways, but the essential method of the Buddha is that life involves suffering and struggle, and that we need to accept this challenge in order to accept our lives. The more I practice psychoanalysis and the more I live, the more I become convinced of this principle. It is true in every way that a statement can be true. Empirically, you can find abundant evidence of the truth of this statement. Psychologically and emotionally, the truth has great resonance. And spiritually, it's an important inspirational message because it becomes the basis of everything that follows. Because it grounds Buddhism in the difficult and painful reality of the aspects of life that involve suffering, pain, and struggle, it gives additional credibility to all of the principles and wisdom that follow. I want to be explicit here about one thing. While the Buddha did say that life involves suffering, we shouldn't take this to mean that life is joyless and needs to be miserable all the time. In fact, my own experience is that once we accept the basic truth of this first statement, we can then begin to look for ways in which to make our lives as filled with real joy and deeply meaningful pleasures and experiences and satisfactions as possible. This occurs on the level of our daily lives, while the other truths occur on the deeper level of our spiritual lives. So back to the first noble truth. I'd like to give a few examples of the kind of suffering caused by our refusal to accept this first noble truth. I once worked with a client named Peter, as in Peter Pan, who refuses to grow up. This man was one of the purest examples I've ever seen of the archetype of the puer eternus, the eternal youth. Peter was a reasonably attractive man in his mid-20s when I met him, and he was stuck in painful psychological conflict during most of the course of his work with me. He complained constantly about everything imaginable. Although objectively his life seemed fine, he was powerfully attached to the idea that everything that he encountered should be different, better, easier than the way it actually was. After some time of working with Peter and offering him some empathy and understanding for his innumerable complaints, I began to intensify my confrontations with him. Peter was a man gifted with remarkable intelligence, affluent parents, and an expensive elite education. He had pretty good health and no trouble dating one woman after another. He had a series of jobs in a highly specialized technical field, working sometimes for industry and sometimes for academic institutions. But no matter what he did or where he lived or whom he dated, things were never good enough. Peter would complain that while the woman he was dating had a perfect personality, she just wasn't quite right. If only, he would sigh, she were just a little bit prettier, then he would be perfectly happy with her and everything would be fine. I would point out that he'd found his previous girlfriend, whom he described as stunningly attractive, to be too superficial and insufficiently intellectual. It was similar with his work life. Working in industry offered sufficient pay, but the work was meaningless. Academics, on the other hand, offered the satisfaction of teaching students and a sense of meaning, but Peter couldn't be happy here either because he needed just another $10,000 per year, and then everything would be perfect. After years and years of these sorts of exchanges, I confronted him more and more directly on the basic issue. He refused to accept the reality of what life offered him. He refused to say yes to the compromises, challenges, struggles, and disappointments that are inevitable in life. Feeling myself rely on the Buddha, I would confront him directly about the assumption that seemed to underlie all of his protests. I said, Peter, you seem to believe that life shouldn't be this hard. You seem to think that it should all be easier and that it should all work out the way you want it to. He agreed that this was correct. And he said, essentially, that until life worked out the way he believed that it should, he would continue to be bitter and refuse to commit to any path because they were all meaningless anyway, and what's the point of trying? Because you end up dead in the end, after all. Now, before you dismiss Peter as some kind of extremely pathological neurotic who could have nothing to do with yourself, I'd like to submit that Peter actually represents a powerful voice within each of us that we all have to struggle heroically against. Many of us know this as a voice from childhood, but it persists at a lower level throughout our lives. Peter got in all kinds of trouble in his life by refusing to accept the first noble truths, but I know that many of us, including me, have recurring difficulty with our refusal to accept the difficulties that life poses every single day. With Peter, the refusal to accept the first noble truth was dramatic and explicit. He stated clearly and repeatedly that life should not be hard for him, and he raged against the reality that repeatedly contradicted his unrealistic expectations. Most of us do not deny the first noble truths with such stubbornness and clarity. Most of us deny this truth in more subtle ways. One of the more subtle ways of denying this is impatience. I'm sure you can all relate to the experience of being angry or resentful at long lines for service at stores, restaurants, or airports. This anger or irritation seems to stem from a core belief: life shouldn't be this hard. Isn't this just another denial of Buddha's first noble truth? If we slow down and tune into our thinking, it runs something similar to this. There shouldn't be such a long line here. They should do something about it. I shouldn't have to wait in this line. It should be easier than this for me. While it's true that in our consumer-oriented society, many organizations do a lot of work to minimize wait times, and you can escape many lines and crowds by careful planning, paying more, shopping less, and other strategies, a certain amount of frustration of this minor count is inevitable. Next time you're stuck in a long line, if you feel the beginnings of this frustration, see if tuning into the First Noble Truth doesn't provide a certain feeling of relief and comfort. Of course this is a long line. After all, shouldn't I expect there will be suffering in this life? Then you'll be in a much better place to either tolerate the inconvenience and make another plan, but you'll do it free from destructive anger. Back to Peter for a moment. I worked with him for many years, gradually increasing the force of my confrontations. At one point, there came a time when I could no longer accept his continual complaining. I essentially gave him a choice. Either he would have to accept the First Noble Truth and shift his attitude, I didn't put it exactly that way, or we could no longer continue to work together. I thought long and hard before making this confrontation. Some of my colleagues would fault me for being too directive, but I chose my time very carefully, handled the confrontation respectfully and with empathy and compassion, aware of how much I shared with Peter. I believe that the ultimatum was necessary and life-affirming. The Buddha himself said that it is not wise to spend your time with fools. And I believe that this expression is similar to Jesus' injunction to not cast your pearls before swine. It's not to treat people who can't accept this reality contemptuously, but it is to acknowledge that the time in this life is finite. And when you think, there's a beautiful inscription at the basement of the Zen Center, some of you may know, it says, "Awake, awake, do not waste this life, time is fleeting." And when we hear the bell, we note how time begins and ends in meditation. The idea is we don't have all the time in the world. So, to my immense joy and to his great credit, Peter chose to grow up and began to reject his complaining side and to become more and more mature and positive. He married an imperfect woman and worked on accepting her shortcomings. He committed to an ethical company that makes a dull but necessary product and devoted himself to becoming a compassionate colleague and boss. Over a number of years, he became more involved in meaningful spiritual practices in a non-Buddhist tradition, which led to satisfying volunteer activities. When he completed analysis, Peter and his wife were expecting their first child. It wasn't lost on me that he was bringing new life into the world, just as his old complex was dying. At our termination session, he stated that he knew that life would continue to be hard, but that he wouldn't be surprised or resentful at the difficulties that presented themselves. While Peter's case was extreme, and of extremely long duration, I believe that we all go through a similar internal struggle. I know that I did. Until I found Buddhism, I believed, like Peter, that life should be fun, exciting, and easy. Sure, I would glibly joke, life's a bitch and then you die, but I didn't really approach the idea with a sober and respectful attitude. Once I began to really meditate on the First Noble Truth, I would let go of my puerile and resentful attitudes and commit myself to life in all of its difficulties. I could feel a reduction in anger, and I was never again surprised by life's difficulties. I want to give you one of Carl Jung's most famous quotes, and you can see how it parallels Buddha's First Noble Truth. He said, "Neurosis is the result of a failure to accept legitimate suffering." The idea is that we make ourselves crazy with conflict if we deny that life involves suffering, and that all of our goals, all of our aspirations involve suffering. If we believe they don't, we'll become neurotic. So in this way, Buddha and Jung are in complete accord. Jung was the son of a Protestant minister who grew up in Switzerland and watched his father lose his faith, but from his father he had a profoundly moral attitude towards therapy. And he had the idea that many young people, like Peter, were stuck in a kind of childhood denial of the difficulties of life. Our culture has raised the denial of death and the denial of the difficulties of life to an art form, and I should know, I used to work in advertising, and the resulting psychopathology and neurotic suffering from the denial and these attitudes is immense. Jung would see my therapeutic task with Peter as being to confront him on his failure to accept the suffering inherent in life and would reduce his neurosis by increasing his ability to tolerate the suffering that he cannot avoid. The thing that I love about both Buddha's First Noble Truth and Carl Jung's formulation about neurotic suffering is that they are both so useful. Once you identify a refusal to accept that life is hard or refuse to accept legitimate suffering, the prescription becomes obvious. You need to learn to accept the pain and difficulty in life and to find a better way to make your life meaningful in spite of those difficulties and disappointments. So, to briefly review the other noble truths. The first noble truth is that life is suffering, pervasive, unsatisfactory. The Pali word is dukkha, which has been translated as just that life never quite works out the way you want. I always think of Mick Jagger's song here about I can't get no satisfaction. So that's the first noble truth. The second noble truth is that this dissatisfaction has a cause. The cause is clinging and its opposite, aversion. When you're grabbing for something, you're hanging on. When you're pushing something away, you're doing the opposite. The third noble truth is that relief is possible. That's what we're all doing here, trying to find some relief from suffering. And the fourth noble truth is that the way to balance and towards clarity, towards having a useful life, is to follow the Eightfold Noble Paths. Now, I've always felt that Buddha was cheating a little bit because it feels like the Eightfold Noble Path is, you know, another one of the fourfold. So what's the math here? Isn't it really 11 Noble Truths? But in any case, the basic truth of the fourth Noble Truth, I find, is to lead a balanced life. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about how failure to observe some of these balances can lead to trouble. So I'd like to introduce the case of Art, who is a 51-year-old gay man, and this will illustrate some of the problems that can be prevented with an understanding of the Dharma. Art came to see me after he'd recently left his job with a publishing company where he'd worked as a senior sales rep for more than 20 years. He'd had good success as a salesman, but when the company reorganized him and offered him a severance package to retire early, Art jumped at the opportunity. He had enough money to avoid work for a while, but nowhere near enough to retire permanently. He said that he wanted some help with perspectives while he made a life transition. He spoke superficially about New Age spirituality and struggled to use complex psychological terms correctly. He spoke of an idealistic desire to do well by doing good and spoke vaguely about a struggle for greater meaning. Art had a number of ideas for his future employment, all of them unrealistic and without grounding. For instance, although he'd never cooked or worked in a restaurant, he considered opening a restaurant or cafe because the Bay Area is ready for a new restaurant concept. Maybe you know Art. Once he began to put pencil to paper, however, he realized that each of his business ideas was in succession too expensive, too difficult to put into practice, or too risky. I was struck by how consistently he externalized the blame for each of the difficulties that he faced. It wasn't that he hadn't saved enough money or done enough planning. It was that rents are too high. It wasn't that he hadn't prepared enough for a demanding career in a difficult field. It was just that there's too much competition. Art reacted with anger, my gentlest attempts to point out the problems I saw with his plans and with the process by which he was making his decisions. He seemed to expect that I would have some magic answer for him that would somehow land the perfect career in his lap without his having to work for it. When I made approximately that statement to him, he retorted that I just didn't understand him. I countered that I understood him very well and offered him several exact quotes that supported my position. Reluctantly, he agreed with me and acknowledged that he was difficulty facing just how hard it would be for him to figure out the next steps in his career. We seemed to be on track for a while. Art then began to complain about the emptiness of his personal life. In his early 50s, he looked back on his romantic life with a sense of shame and regret. He'd been unable to sustain a relationship of longer than a few months. He was currently dating a South American graduate student who lived in another state, and he complained about how infrequently they saw each other. The student was from a conservative culture and was closeted and secretive about his sexuality. I was struck by how few details Art provided me about his romantic life and history. Always a danger sign if when someone's vague, I know I need to get real specific. And I began to ask him progressively more probing questions, insisting on details and specifics. He told me that the graduate student, whom I'll call Juan, was short on money and that Art had to pay for the travel between the cities. I asked him about Juan's age, and Art was evasive, finally stating only that he was in his 20s. Art said that as he and Juan saw each other so rarely, he was exploring dating other men but finding it difficult. He said, "You know how difficult it is to date, with the gay community being the way it is." I said, "What do you mean?" And he bitterly castigated the gay community of San Francisco for its superficiality, obsession with looks, materialism, unfriendliness, and ageism. I asked Art to tell me more about how he'd come to these conclusions. I learned that Art had several active profiles up on websites. He blithely told me that he presented himself on his web as near on his web profile as nearly 10 years younger than he actually was, because everyone does it on the internet. He then complained about what a superficial town San Francisco was, because everyone's focused on young guys. He complained with bitterness and anger about how difficult it was to get a date. Art was of average looks, and he definitely looked his age. When I asked him whether or not he got any replies to his website, he complained, "Only from old guys." I asked him how old the old guys was, and he said, "Oh, you know, 40 and up." Maybe you know Art. So from
maybe
a Jungian,
we are Art.
Maybe we are Art. All of us, right? So from a Jungian perspective, Art was stuck at an earlier developmental level. He'd come out in his 20s and continued to seek the hot excitement and sexuality appropriate to a man 30 years younger than he was. He rejected others closer to his age and expected that he could attract much younger lovers. He was furious that his expectation wasn't met and was bitterly disappointed with the paucity of young suitors that his web pages attracted. As kindly as I could, I told Art that I thought he was playing a game whose rules he either didn't understand or refused to accept. To obviate the former possibility, I worked with him to enumerate the rules for hot sex hookups on the internet. And they're really pretty obvious, aren't they? I mean, this is a market exchange. I got, you got, do you want to? You know, it's bargaining at the purest level. We agreed that the rules were based on superficial attractiveness, or money, or drugs, and that age was a distinct disadvantage that needed to be compensated by other qualities. As we listed these rules together, Art became visibly angrier. I asked him about his feelings, and he could barely contain his rage with me. He sputtered that, "It seems like you don't have any sympathy for me and for how hard it is." I countered that I had enormous sympathy, but that I believed that we had to begin from a basis of understanding what was really going on so that we could develop a plan that would work for him. This confrontation proved too much for Art. He missed several of his next sessions and didn't respond to my calls or emails inviting him to come back. I closed his case and had not heard from him again. Now, from a Buddhist point of view, Art certainly showed a failure to accept right view, the first of the Noble Eightfold Path that Buddha recommends to his followers. Remember that the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path, which is a means to alleviate the suffering of being in this world. Right view is the ability to see clearly what is actually happening and to accept the truth as you see it. Your view of the world must be reasonably in accord with what is called consensus reality, or the reality that society determines is true and necessary for allowing society to function in an orderly manner. But right view also includes the understanding of the basic workings of karma, at least in your own lifetime. So I could say a little bit more about the case of Art, which is that from a Jungian point of view, he was someone who failed the necessary developmental task of progressive mourning. Jung said that we're always mourning our life, that as soon as we become adjusted to something, we need to begin to let it go, which is awfully Buddhist, isn't it? And certainly if those of you who are older than 22, which I think is most of us, can think about, if you came out in your early 20s, you had this, or at least I had this wonderful experience of, you know, the bars in Boston filled with gorgeous, hot young men, all of whom wanted to have sex with me, and or seemed to, or I had that fantasy and acted on it enough to get it out of my system. And every now and then I regret being older, but I can look back on that period of my life and say, you know what, I really smelled those flowers, I drank that wine, it was great, and I learned what it had to offer and could let it go. Now, not all of us have had that opportunity. Some of us came out later, or some of us wish we had done things, but we need to be aware of mourning progressively as we go on. And I think if we don't do that, then we don't have right view, which of course in psychological terms is denial. And if we don't have right view, we can't understand karma. I'd like to talk a little bit about another case that illustrates how I understand karma to work and goes right back to the Noble Eightfold Path. So karma is best explained in Buddhist terms as the principle of dependent origination, which simply stated means that because this is so, this happens. This will come into being because that happened. It's an understanding of the law of cause and effect, and its clear implication is for us to take responsibility for our actions in this lifetime so that we and the world around us can benefit from our wise and skillful actions. Art is actually a spectacular example of a complete failure to appreciate karma or to have right view. One of the most important results of a consistent meditation practice is the ability to look at and understand reality. Art was in such psychological pain that he was unable to see the world as it really is. As a result, he suffered enormously, and the plans he made were built on the flimsiest of foundations. Art didn't understand the basic workings of cause and effect or karma. He didn't see the rules of the game for internet dating, just as he didn't see those rules for an entrepreneurial business, just as he didn't understand the rules for the game of life, nor did he understand it for psychoanalysis and therapy. From a Jungian point of view, art was in the middle of the classic midlife crisis, a problem of the modern world that Jung defined, described, and illustrated. Art had had some success in his career, but needed to continue working. Art was responding to the inner promptings in his life that are characteristics of a midlife crisis, which is a demand for meaning. A midlife crisis is an inner surge of something that comes up within us that says, I've got to find more meaning in our life. And it here I want to say something about Joseph Campbell. A lot of you will know Joseph Campbell was a comparative mythologist who was inspired by Jung's work. And he basically charted the path of the hero. And in the middle of life, all of us, according to Jung and Campbell and Dante, will be challenged with a crisis of meaning. How do I make my life meaningful? And Campbell has a famous adage that says, follow your bliss, follow what makes you happy. And that's a wonderful way to look at what is deeply pleasurable for you, look at the things that call to you. But Jung would say, follow your bliss and be prepared to pay for it. Because your bliss may lead you to a place that is going to require a lot of hard work and a lot of hard sacrifice. And people sometimes superficially understand or misunderstand Jung as saying, just follow your bliss and everything will be all right. Jung wouldn't say that. Jung would say, follow your bliss and you've got to be ready to sacrifice. So finally, I want to illustrate the principles of right speech, right action, and right sexuality, which are some of the other statements that are in the Eightfold Noble Paths. And I'd like to talk about Tom, who's a gay man in his mid-30s, who came to me because of an internal conflict between his desire to keep hanging out with his single gay male friends and his commitment to his lover. Tom described his lover, Dick, as the perfect match for him. I was hoping to get a laugh there. Okay, thank you. You guys are too mature. But Tom complained that he had become boring lately and that he nagged Tom to be at home and take care of their dogs. Tom and Dick had a monogamous relationship, and Tom felt a tremendous amount of guilt because of his sexual encounters outside of their relationship. His conflict was intensified as he had recently become drunk and slept with a colleague at work who enjoyed the experience and hinted that he wouldn't mind a repeat encounter. Those of you in human resources are curling your toes, I imagine, at this point. Tom and Dick enjoyed a friendship with this colleague, whom I'll call Harry. Harry had been over a number of times to Tom and Dick's houses for dinner and visits before and after Tom had sex with him. Tom and Harry kept this a secret from Dick. Tom and Dick had been together for 10 years and had earlier broken up over Dick's anger at Tom's sexual infidelity earlier in the relationship. Their breakup had hurt Tom deeply and had left him feeling guilty and disconsolate as he sought Dick's reluctance to reluctantly given forgiveness. As a result, Tom was terrified about disclosing his sexual liaisons outside the relationship to Dick. Tom had maneuvered himself into a position where there was no easy way to go forward, and he was becoming increasingly agitated as he rehearsed ways that he would dodge Dick's questions about outside sexual activity. Tom appreciated Dick for his quiet and calm approach to life, and he valued his sexual and emotional fidelity. He was, in reality, very dependent on Dick, but was frightened by this dependency, and sought to deny it by behaving like a single man. In therapy with me, Tom, the son of a police officer and an intelligence agent, was deeply concerned with the possibility that information of our work would fall into the wrong hands. His suspicions made it difficult for him to confide in me and made him worry about what would happen if Dick or anyone else found out about his extramarital affairs. Tom stated repeatedly that he was too ashamed of his sexual activity to confide in it to Dick, so he concealed it using a range of truth management strategies ranging from careful avoidance all the way through to outright lying, fabrication, and deception. Because of Tom's shame about psychotherapy, his shame of his sexual activities, and his shame of his dependence on Dick, and by extension, his shame of being with me as a psychoanalyst, I was in an extremely awkward position. On the one hand, if I confronted Tom with the consequences of his deception in such a way as to amplify the shame he was feeling, he would probably leave therapy and would reject whatever I might have to say. On the other hand, if I continued letting Tom continue with his current strategies, he would be preparing the way for a predictable deterioration in his marriage with Dick. Here, both Jung and Buddha came to my aid. Jung spends a lot of time about holding the opposites and the problem of the opposites. He says that this is a problem that's common to human thought and interaction, in which every position brings up its opposite, and wherever there is a high, there must be a low, wherever there is love, there must also be hatred, wherever we see honesty, we also see dishonesty, wherever there is a persona or a public presentation of the face, there must also be a shadow. So this is Jung's very helpful idea. Jung believed that we could get caught or trapped or polarized in one or the other extreme, and that this polarization was a terrible way to go through life. In the above case, Tom is caught between two polarities, the polarity of being honest and shameful and risking the relationship, or being dishonest and concealing and living with deceit and lies. Similarly, I was caught in a polarity of either confronting Tom on his dishonesty and its consequences, or colluding with him, with varying degrees of passivity, in his deceitfulness. So I'm presented with this idea of, what do? I've taken the bodhisattva view, and I'm thinking, of course, first of my client Tom, but I'm also thinking of Dick with compassion. Jung states that the only way out of a polarized situation is something he calls the transcendent function, or a third possibility, which emerges from hard work and allows the psyche to outgrow the tension of the opposites. In the case of Tom, the transcendent function that emerged in our work together was my understanding of right speech, karma, and dependent origination. As I was wondering how I could work with Tom in such a way as to bring him back to a more solid basis for moving forward, the thought of karma occurred to me. Rather than lecturing him on how his practicing ways in which he deceived his lover would lead to alienation between him and Dick, I decided to ask him a series of gentle questions. Tom responded to my questions with agitation. He could see that his deceiving Tom would lead to bad energy between the two of them. His deceiving Dick would lead to bad energy, but he was deeply ashamed of his behavior outside the relationship, and he asked me to help him find another way. As we were doing this, I had one of these moments that Jung calls the spirit of Mercury, or a visit of a little angel. And I used to think of these as distracting thoughts and push them away, but I've come to welcome them and love them. They make my work a lot of fun. I had a little daydream, and the daydream was from the movie Moonstruck. And this was a scene that happened to me as Tom was talking. In this scene, Olympia Dukakis, who plays Rose Camarero, the mother of the Cher character, is confronting her husband, who's played by Vincent Gardina. His name is also Vincent in the movie. Rose knows that her husband has been carrying on with a mistress. She asks him, "Have I been a good wife to you?" He responds that she has. She then tells him, "I want you to stop seeing her." He starts to protest and says, "What do you mean? And she takes his finger and puts it on his lips and says, "Don't." Meekly, he agrees to stop seeing his mistress. And several weeks later, at the end of the movie, the two old lovers are heard in bed beginning to make love. First, a word about how this scene came to me. This is an example of what Jung calls the spirit of Mercury. Mercury, the messenger god who connects the lower world with the upper world with us. Mercury was the only god who could travel between and would bring these little messages. And it's a perfect archetypal comment on the scene that's happening. Two old lovers who truly love each other but can't imagine it or can't be honest about it. Does that mean I'm time?
That was a synchronicity.
I've got just a minute. So one of the synchronicities was that Tom was a huge Cher fan. And he knew the scene instantly, and he could see the applicability that it had to his life. And generally, when people are cheating in a relationship, the other spouse almost always knows it, or at least knows that something was wrong. And what happened was this scene came to my mind as a way to get me and Tom out of the bind that we were in and said, the answer, Tom, is not that you stop seeing Harry. The answer is that you start loving Dick and yourself more. And then what can happen is that years from now you'll have a scene. And I said this, I imagined, Tom, that, you know, Dick, you're going to turn to Dick and say, "Dick, you know, I got to get something off my chest." And he'll say, "Don't. I know." And he got this. And it helped, and it helped their relationship. So the case examples are to help you get a sense of how I try to integrate my work as a Jungian analyst with my work as a Buddhist practitioner. And I hope that they've provided some examples of food for thought and ways that these two Dharma gates sustain me in my practice. So thank you very much, and I welcome questions now. Yes, sir.
Thank you. The word analysis is such a rational word.
Yes.
And to me, the appeal of Jungian stuff is it's irrational.
Yes.
It's the ocean. It's stuff welling up. It's because rationality is not going to help me. I'm a smart guy.
That's right.
I've got to be surprised, and that's why dreams and stuff, I think, are part of it. So the word, the phrase Jungian analysis seems contradictory. So could you talk about the role of the irrational?
Sure.
And you can't talk your way into this.
No, you cannot talk your way into this. I would have a gentle shading, which is that I would not say that Jungian analysis is irrational. I would say it is non-rational. And we can all think very clearly, but what we need to do is open the gate, open the way for the kinds of non-rational thoughts like that scene from Cher that played to me. And that's why we do a lot of work with dreams. The other thing that I would say here, and this is why I asked everyone to begin with a metta meditation, is that one of the things that really sustains me about Buddhism is the Dalai Lama's practice of loving kindness. There's a lot of time when I don't know what the heck I'm doing, and I just sit there in respect, in love, in kindness and compassion. And I think that, to me, the great shadowing problem with a lot of Freudian analysis is that people try to think their way out of being human. And that's why people have been, I will include myself in this, deeply wounded by overly rational Freudian analysts who can be just frankly kind of mean sometimes. So that's why I'm a Jungian. Thank you. Great question. Yes, sir.
Sir.
Well,
Madam for public.
Okay, yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Just the opposite. There's a word in German?
Yes.
Schadenfreude.
Schadenfreude, yes.
It's a great concept. So my curiosity is a little bit about the embracing of Schadenfreude.
Well, this would be embracing the shadow, and I think that goes back to right view. And when you practice Buddhist meditation, you are going to meet with your shadow, and you will see yourself. Schadenfreude means the delight in the pain of others. And I would call this a shadow aspect, and I'd also call it an unskillful state in Buddhist terms. Because from my understanding of the Dharma, to delight in the pain of others is unskillful, because what you want to practice is compassion. So I would say when you see it, you would identify it, acknowledge it, and let it depotentiate or drain of its energy. Because to have joy in the pain of others is contrary to metta practice, and then I would try to recenter in the Dharma and in the idea of compassion.
Is it the opposite of mudita?
I think it is. Mudita is compassionate joy. So I would think it is the opposite. Yes, good question. And Jack, I saw your hand up.
No, yeah. No, I just wanted to define
schadenfreude. Oh, schadenfreude means...
I know.
Yeah. Joy in the pain of others.
I don't think it's necessarily
in the pain of others. Sometimes it's just the hysteria of awfulness. You know, how things can be so terrible that they make you laugh.
I would call that anxiety and angst.
Well, like a guy comes up from his tornado shelter and everything is gone. And he starts to laugh because it's so complete.
I'd call that a kind of hysteria or mania. I don't know.
I think it's sort of sane.
Well, my understanding of Schadenfreude, which could be incorrect, is that it is a kind of a sadistic joy in the pain of others.
Yeah. Like Paris Hilton?
Yes. I think that's right, and I think that's a sadistic joy in the pain of others, and I think that shows the deterioration of our culture, because that's what fuels a lot of the gossip rags. We want to build people up so we can tear them down, which is the Jungian polarities. But then from a Buddhist point of view, if you slow down and meditate, you say, what the hell am I doing wasting my life on this trivia, right? It's just not worth it. And that's why our meditation practice would bring you back to a more meaningful way of using your time. Other questions? Yes.
Yes. In choosing a therapist to work with, mm-hmm. how important is the person's sexual orientation or the spiritual practice?
Well, I think it's very important. And if you go to my website, justinheck.com, and I'm not recruiting here, but I offer this to you as a practice, or as a way. I have a thing there about how to choose a therapist. And I think you want to use, thank you to you, you want to use both your mind and your heart. And I would say try to interview or meet with two or three people and use your head and go to the websites of the licensing agency and see, does this person have complaints? How long have they been licensed? Where did they go to school? Those are all important. But then say, how do I feel? Does this person have a sense of humor? Do I feel respected? There are many Buddhists who don't come to a Buddhist sangha, if you know what I mean. There are many people on their own spiritual path who haven't defined it. There are many, I've been tremendously helped by straight women psychotherapists, and I've been hurt by gay male therapists. So, and I've been very helped by people who are interested in Kabbalah and Jewish traditions, but who respect my Buddhism. So what really matters is respect, empathy, competence, intelligence. And you'll know pretty quickly whether it's a good fit. Thanks, Kay. Jim, yeah.
I know you're not presenting yourself as a Buddhist expert, but is there a Buddhist notion that would be equivalent to Jung's vast appreciation of the benevolence of the energies in the unconscious so that dreams heal people?
Yes, well, I think of that as the turning of the wheel of the Dharma, which is consonant with Jung's idea of the river of life archetype. And it was a dream that actually brought me to Buddhism. Do I have a moment? Or?
Sure.
Okay. So I had a dream that blew me away shortly after I saw a man die in Varanasi in India in 1988. This was what brought me to Buddhism. And in the dream, I saw the soul of the man come to me and speak to me words of benevolence. And as I saw him in this dream, I also saw a river of beings also who had died and gone before me. And I saw this enormous river that I was part of. And it reminded me of a book that I had read in my German class back in the ninth grade, Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, where Siddhartha repeats again and again, the wheel turns but is forever still. And Jung's idea is that life is a river and that we flow and that the river is always changing but always the same. And just as a drop of water from a river is always changing, so is the river of life. And I think in Buddhist meditation or in yogic meditation, if you feel the, I want to say Shaktipat, but what the Kundalini energy rising that connects the different chakras of the body, To me, that is equivalent to the Buddhist idea of appreciation of the wheel of the Dharma turning, where we are all, where we are everything. And this also goes to Jung's notion, I could go on for hours, but the idea of both inflation and deflation. Jung said that we were constantly expanding infinitely and contracting down to nothing. So it shouldn't be amazing, this guy emerging from his tornado would suddenly be, you know, absolutely delighted to be alive. And would, as the Dharma wheel turns, this man would be filled with gratitude and the wonder of life. And then as the wheel turns the next day and he has to go deal with Allstate, you know, he's going to be pretty deflated, is my guess. And I think that's how I think of it in Buddhist terms, that the wheel of life is the same as this. And Buddhist practitioners, I think Stephen Levine quotes the Buddha as talking about the simultaneous realization of everything and nothingness. That when you get a sense of your loss of ego boundaries that connects you to the wonder of life, you become aware of the vastness that you are as you connect with all of humanity and all that has been and all that will be and all of your potential. And you feel huge and empowered. It's a glorious feeling, right? But then as you connect with this little life and how short it is and how it's like a bubble, just a thought, just a vanishing thing, and you can't put yourself, that there really is no self that exists. So you become completely deflated. So I hear Jung as being just another bodhisattva who really is you know, bringing up words that to me sound just like the Dharma. So that's why I love these two Dharma gates, why they how they sustain me in the work that I do. And I think I probably should stop there. So thank you very much, everyone.
And now it's time for announcements. Do we have a host today?
I'm the host, so there's banana and pumpkin bread and tea. Mm-hmm. And I'll be coming around with a Donna bowl with, we suggest, $5 to $8, more or less, depending on what you can afford. And there's also should be a sign-up sheet if you're new and would like to receive a newsletter, or even if you're old and would like to receive a newsletter.
Yes, I'll explain for the newcomers. We rent this space from another Buddhist group, so our Donna Bowl is in economical crispy plastic, and it's out by the coffee urn. And there's a brass bowl there, which is for the center here. So we're bringing around the plastic bowl, which are contributions that go to us. You're welcome to contribute to the other center too, but that's not what we're advertising for at the moment. And the pink sheets are the sign-up sheets. You can get the newsletter in email format or snail mail format for both. And we also have a directory, a membership directory, which is voluntary. There are copies out there which you can claim. And if you want to be in the directory, you can sign up and say that. You can make lots of decisions at the moment you sign up. But just put your name down and you'll get to all the other things eventually. And people sometimes go out for lunch. There's a group that forms kind of amorphously at the end of the coffee hour. If you linger by the door or lurk, you'll probably figure out who's going. Are there any other announcements?
Yeah. My name is Michael Murphy. I'm taking over the coordination of the GBF retreat from Kay Matsuda. So, first of all, I want to acknowledge
Kay's wonderful service.
All of this good work. And the annual retreat happens in October in the Santa Cruz Mountains at a place called Vajrapani, a Tibetan center. And I would love to do it collaboratively, so if anybody is interested, it's a time-limited commitment. And I'd also love any feedback about teachers that you might be interested in having. So,
do you have the data written?
I think there is a date.
Yeah, October 12th through 14th.
Thank you.
So see me if you have any feedback. Thank you.
Is that Columbus Day weekend? Pardon? Is that Columbus Day? So we have another day off?
I don't think so.
I'm Bill Childs. Brooke Golden coordinates one of our community services, which is a correspondence project with prisoners. And unfortunately, because of a prior commitment at work, he's unable to make it today. But we had scheduled a reading of the letters that we've received this month after fellowship this morning. So anybody that's interested in taking part, we go through the letters and sort them as to the requests that the prisoners make, and sometimes there's a particularly meaningful or moving letter that we'll read aloud and share. So anybody that's interested, please join me around the coffee table, maybe about 15 minutes after the fellowship has taken place.
Any other announcements?
Darren. A group of us meet, my name's Darren, and a group of us on Tuesday nights meet at my house to practice metta meditation, which is what Justin described earlier. So if anyone's interested, it's from 7:30 to 8:30 on Tuesday nights at my house at Baker and Fulton Street near the Panhandle. So if you're interested in joining us, just approach me and I'll give you the rest of the information.
Any other announcements?
Next week, our speaker is Brian Baker, who is a phenomenally gifted musician. He's the pianist and choral director of the Masterworks Chorale, and he in our ongoing for Sunday series on exploring the human voice and its capacity to enhance joy and presence. He's going to lead us in sort of not a fire rehearsal, but we're going to explore resonance, voice production, breathing, and doing some singing together, so he's a terrific teacher as well. So we haven't done anything like this before, so I hope you enjoy. If you've ever enjoyed singing, even in the shower, please come.
I'd also like to remind the newcomers that we have some extra copies of the newsletter there. The back of the newsletter lists the speakers for the next few weeks, and the complete schedule calendar is available on the website, which is www.kbuddhist.org. And the talks that are given here are made available on the website through the kindness of George Hubbard and some other people. So you can also go to the website and click on the archive. Is it the archives that it's called?
It says audio.
Audio. And it takes a week or two for the talks to appear, but they're all there, and there's some very interesting things there that you can listen to.
Currently at about 180 talks.
It's really quite
a bit.
Any other announcements? Okay, then I guess we'll stand and hold hands and do the dedication. Right, would you like to receive the dedication?
Sure.
And do you have one memorized, or do you want one?
No, I'll do one. All right.
Okay. I'm not an expert in this either, so we'll just do it. By the power and truth of this practice, may we dedicate this practice that all beings may be filled with loving kindness, that all beings may be peaceful and content, all beings may be healthy and well, and all beings may be peaceful and joyful.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month, and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.